Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Time for Spectrum West. It's a Thursday. It's the 20th day of March. It is the vernal equinox day. We're still looking for spring, however, I think Mother Nature lost it somewhere. It's around here somewhere, I think. On this rendition of Spectrum West, we're going to hear from the indefatigable Jerry Way. I love that word, indefatigable. Getting ready to put on yet another show on the stage at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. It's called Gold Town Showdown, and wait till you hear about the weapons they've chosen with which to duel. Actor Patrick O'Brien is back at the Spectrum West microphones, actually on the Spectrum West telephone. From his home in the Twin Cities, the Eau Claire guy returns to West Wisconsin, the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls, in a one-guy show called The Fever. Jim Oliver is traveling out east, but before he left, he recorded a conversation with Jim Thompson, directing Dixie Swim Club for the Amory Community Theater. It opens Friday at the high school in Amory. While we're on the topic of opening, that's what we're going to do to this program right now. For years, Antiques Roadshow has been, as their letterhead states it, discovering America's hidden treasures. The staff is gearing up for another big season, and as a fan, I've persistently wondered about what it takes to get this show off the ground. Literally, each year, each location, and each production. I finally couldn't take it, the unsatisfied curiosity, any longer, so I went straight to the top, to the executive producer. Her name is Marcia Bemko. She's affiliated with the show's flagship station, WGBH, in Boston, and I placed a call a little bit earlier this week. I don't really know, Marcia, the history of the Roadshow. Where did the idea originate? Was it right where you are?
We have to give credit where credit is due. It was originally the BBC, and they still do produce a show called Antiques Roadshow.
I didn't know that.
And they sure do, and we license the right to do our show from them. We are getting ready to tape season 19, mm-hmm. and as we're doing season 19, they will be doing season 37.
Yikes.
So we've got a long life ahead of us if their existence is any evidence of what's to come. And it's still, by the way, one of the most popular, they call it factual shows in England, one of their most popular factual shows in that country.
I like that term. We ought to use factual shows.
Yes, instead of documentary or nonfiction, yes, factual. That's what they say. And so it still tops their list. So mm-hmm. wherever Antiques Roadshow is produced, people like it.
Wow. How about your involvement from the beginning, or did you jump
Not from the very beginning, and okay. I like to joke that had I been here in year one, I may not be here now because I don't think anybody's left. I came in season four, and as we get ready to go out now to tape season 19. So I've been here quite a long time. I've been here 15 years. Uh-huh. I make that joke because they had a lot to figure out in those first 4 years. We're still figuring stuff out. After every city, we'll make adjustments as we tour. It's an organic thing, as things are always changing. As much as you see and know your friendly roadshow on the air, mm-hmm. we're always working to make it better.
The license that you hold to do the show, does it strap you, or can you get creative and go off on some of your own tangents once in a while?
You know, the thing is, it straps us in that we have North American rights. And so that's really the only way it gets in the way. And if you've anybody who's ever out there, and I've talked to many people who have, and you can watch it in some places, mm-hmm. the BBC's version of Antiques Roadshow. And it is very much like our show, except with a very British flavor. Mm-hmm. We very much Americanize our show just by being us.
Yeah. So they travel around and go to city to city?
They
like
do.
You do?
Okay. But the difference in their country is they don't fly anywhere.
Ah.
So they do more shows, and they don't have to ticket their events the way they do it. The challenges of living in such a large country present with it a different strategy, a different logistic approach.
Sure.
They probably do 20-odd events a year. They have about 1,000 to 2,000 people show up at their events. The difference for us is we ticket our events. We have, by planning, 5,000 to 6,000 people will show up. But our record is 35,000 people registering for those 3,000 pairs of tickets we give out to the public. And that's why we can't let people just line up.
Holy moly.
Holy moly. Good news for us. No, I can feel the love.
I was going to ask if, you know, the popularity of the program surprised you, but then it didn't, because you had pioneers over in the UK who had proven that it's a popular format.
The folks who were here for year one, as I hear those stories told, when that first season, when they went out to record, they were calling people to come to the show because people weren't showing up because nobody knew what it was. It hadn't yet broadcast. After it broadcast, season two came, and in that season, Los Angeles, or another West Coast city was in that season. I think it was San Francisco. Anyways, they had to basically shut down the freeways there because so many people lined up. And they realized right after they broadcast what a smashing success the events were going to be. And ratings do tell us that more people are watching the show, I think, than beyond anyone's wildest dreams. And it continues. We continue to have great success. Knock on wood.
On the phone with us, Marcia Bemko. She's executive producer of Antiques Roadshow. Somewhere in my cynical side, I can't help but to think that the beginning of Antiques Roadshow was lobbied by people in the appraisal business.
It's not true. No? I think that the farthest thing from their minds when WGBH approached the experts that we work with was a show, and could it even work? And those experts who worked with us in those early seasons, many of them still with us, took a real gamble. They deserve a lot of credit. They pay their own way. They pay their own expenses. They pay their own hotel nights. They give them lunch on Saturday. And so they are making an investment to do this in the beginning. The credit for the idea belongs to a now-retired vice president here at WGBH, Peter McGee. He loved this show when he went to England. He would go for business often. He said, let's try 1 hour, and you see what became of that.
So I love it.
He deserves the credit in this country for coming up with the idea. The experts went along, and they deserve credit for having the faith. Now, because they did, it's worth their investment. We've changed some of their lives, but they still come, and they still don't. We still don't pay them. And if we had to, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I guess I'm not talking necessarily about the people who are on the show, but also just the appraisal business. I mean, it's made people look at things that were in the attic before and say, well, you know, I better get this looked at, whereas before they may not have.
And I hope that is what's happened. I think before Roadshow came along, I know this is true for myself, I had no idea it was possible for furniture to exist that sold for over $1 million for one piece. And I don't think most of us knew that was possible. And that you might have something of value that if we've taught you nothing else but to ask more than one person about it, and especially if you're going to sell something. Now, most of us aren't lucky enough to own extraordinary valuable things. They're rare. But if you do and you want to sell it, I know it's like selling a house. You don't talk to one real estate broker. You compare your deals. And I'm glad we've taught people that, because as I hear it told from the old timers, that's what pickers used to do. They'd drive from house to house. This is the old story. And they'd knock on doors and they'd say, do you have any screens to sell? And where do people keep their window screens when they're not using them? In the attic or the basement. And it would give the picker the opportunity to walk through the house and say, oh, by the way, you want to sell that bureau? And they'd say, yeah, that's a good old one. And they'd offer $5,000, which would knock some farmer over. But what the farmer didn't know way back then is that the bureau was worth $50,000. And we've stopped, I hope, a lot of that.
And on the surface, the thing that really surprises me is how many people I run into if we're discussing things over a beer or lunch, and I find out, not expecting it, that they love Roadshow, too. I mean, it's such a broad perspective of different kinds of people.
Well, because this is radio, you can't see that big grin on my face right now.
No, I mean, really, it is.
By the way, for as long as I produce the show, I'll never get sick of hearing that. Wherever I go, I find the same thing. And people, before they even know what I do, may make mention of it. And you hear us mentioned in pop culture. You'll hear us mentioned in on network shows where somebody will raise, I just was watching Antiques Roadshow. We are a part of the pop culture scene. We have become mainstream.
PBS must be very happy with it being in its lineup because it literally brings people to PBS who may not ever come for any other reason.
I think there was some research that said just that some years ago. We do have 8, 9 million viewers a week. Whether you're on PBS or on a network, that's a nice size audience.
No kidding.
Doesn't matter where you are. That's a lot of people watching television. And I think the evidence that PBS is happy with it is we've been on Monday nights at 8 for a very, very long time.
It's 7 where I live.
It's 7 where you live. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, 8, yeah. 7 Central.
Yeah, good. Way to go. I'm glad you got that in. You know, again, on the surface, it would appear to me that a show like this might be a logistical nightmare. But I have a feeling that the fact that you've been doing it for 19 years means a lot of those things have ironed themselves out. You have to find a place. You do go to some cities I wouldn't expect, you know, a lot of people to bring antiques to the location. Then you have to have all your people come in and show up. Then you have to ticket those people. Then you have to herd them through in a, you know, in lines. I almost went to one in Madison, Wisconsin once. I did not go. It's an interesting process, isn't it?
It's an overwhelming process. You use the N-word, which we don't use, nightmare. we have, experience is the best teacher, and we've learned a lot. I have an event producer, which is a year-round job, by the way. You produce the events themselves. We produce an event, and we produce 8 of them to enable us to get the footage, and frankly, serve a public service for most who are coming won't be taped, but they will learn something about what they own. Occasionally we're stumped, but for the most part, if we're stumped, we point you in the right direction. but we're there to perform a public service and make sure you learn something about what you own before you walk out the door.
In the motion picture business, executive producers are oftentimes the folks with the money. I have a feeling you're not that kind.
No, I'm not writing any checks.
No.
They're still paying me. An executive producer, you know, every television show operates a little differently.
Yeah.
And my role on this show is I produce the show as well as executive producer. Now I have producers working for me, one who is fully in charge of all Mark Wahlberg segments. And I have others who greatly help me do that because it's a lot of work. We make 35 new episodes of television a year, and no one makes TV by themselves.
How long's Wahlberg been with it?
He has been with us since season 10, so this is his 10th year he'll be taping. So he's got a little anniversary coming with us.
Do you have a waiting line for cities to have one to host the Antiques Roadshow?
Oh, yes. At the holiday time, occasionally we might even get some food baskets for cities hoping we'll come to their place.
No kidding.
And what we try to do is when we select our 8 locations, we have some little rules that we follow here. First is, have we been to your city in the last 5 years? Mm-hmm. We're not going to repeat a city in any less than that amount of time. With 8 cities, we're going to try and spread ourselves out across the country as evenly as we can. But those of us who work here think it's a tiny country. There's nowhere left to go sometimes. We're limited to having convention centers. We need 80 to 100,000 square feet of space.
Okay.
There are states that don't have that. And we're trying to work around that so we can get ourselves to every state finally.
Mm-hmm.
We won't, I don't think, anytime get to Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, or Wyoming.
Come on.
Those are states where they haven't a venue, told us. So we have some limitations in mind, and that's the basic ones. But that limits it to very often one venue per state that can hold us. Not in a state like Texas, by the way.
Yeah.
They have a lot of venues.
Are you part of the scout team? Is there such a thing as a scout?
I sure do. I have a scout team, but I have an associate producer and my event producer who go out with an engineer to look at a place. And frankly, even before we go out to do that, we get CAD drawings, if anybody out there knows what I'm talking about, to make sure that it's worth our trip to go. Basically, one of the challenges for us, and this may be a little boring to some, but for those who care, we have a lighting truss that has to go up, and very often columns are holding a structure up that don't allow for our lighting truss. So it's little details like that once you get down to, do you have the space, do you have a venue, then we start to drill down, can you hold our event? And the answer is not always yes. And when it is, it gets into our list of an option for a place for us to go.
Mm-hmm. I knew it was going to be interesting talking to a person behind the scenes of the Antiques Roadshow, and it has been. Marcia Bemko, I appreciate you being with us. Keep in touch. We love the show, and I speak for a lot of people.
Thank you. I love hearing that. Keep watching. Great interview.
Antiques Roadshow. I swear, you could literally walk down the street of any American city, village, or town and ask people if they've heard of it, get responses like, are you Barmy? I wouldn't miss it. Yes, even in the most unexpected places. Antiques Roadshow on Wisconsin Public Television, Monday evenings at 7, in case you don't know. One of the few that hasn't discovered it. Let me know how you like it. Coming up, The Oliver Report, actor Patrick O'Brien, and a new Jerry Way musical on Spectrum West. We're happy to tell you, support for Wisconsin Public Radio and Spectrum West comes from the Water Street Deli in Eau Claire, offering fresh hummus, baba ganoush, and pita chips, and a lot more. Available at the deli, the downtown farmers market, and Just Local Foods. On Facebook and at waterstreetdeliandgrocery.com. Here's a Spectrum memo Friday night at the State Theater in Eau Claire. See the Theater of Illusion, described as modern-day Houdinis in a big high-tech stage show. It's combination Broadway, rock concert, and impossible. Details and tickets at 832-ARTS and online at eauclairearts.com. Remember, Arts West 35 is up and open at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. 64 pieces from 49 artists are on display through the 4th of April. Spectrum West continues with a shot of Oliver. Jim Oliver reaching out to the community theater in Amory.
Jim Thompson is the director of the Amory Community Theater production of Dixie Swim Club. The show opens Friday, March 21st, and plays through March 29th at the Amory High School Auditorium. Jim Thompson joins us to talk about the play and about the Amory Community Theater. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Well, thank you, Jim, for having me on here. I appreciate that.
Tell us about Dixie Swim Club. What's it all about?
Well, the Dixie Swim Club is about five Southern women whose friendships began years ago when they were the college swim team. They set aside a long weekend every August to meet at a beach cottage in North Carolina's Outer Banks to catch up on what's going on in their lives. In the play, we use four different weekends where they come to the cottage at four different times in their lives, once when they're 44, once when they're 49, again at 54, then at 75. We have Sherry, the team captain, who tries to maintain a perfect life. And Dinah, the wisecrack, overachiever, lawyer. Lexi, pampered, outspoken, a true Southern belle. Bernadette, a school teacher, kind of living in basically the backwoods. And Jerry Neal, who is a nun who has left the convent. Their mantra, I guess, would be no men, no work, no kids, just the girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through different things in life, different aspects of their lives as they're going through the four different scenes. See what's going on. See where their life is going.
Who is in the cast? Who play these characters?
Okay, we have Laura Shulgren, who plays Lexi. Marilyn Sala plays Dinah. Shannon Schacht plays Cherie. Jerry Neal is played by Kathy Christensen. And Bernadette is Emily Flatten.
Okay, so now there's also a dinner and a show promotion. How does that work?
We're trying to bring people in to see the show, also to bring a little bit more revenue to some of the restaurants in Amory. So we got together with five of the downtown restaurants. We have Amory Family Restaurant, Garibaldi's, Ida Mae's, The Country Hearth, and Village Pizzeria. They are offering $1 off their menu item, and we are offering $2 off a theater ticket. Eat at one of the restaurants and buy a ticket from them, and then go to the show that night.
Uh-huh. So they sell the tickets to the show as well as the meals.
Yes.
It's hopefully
a help for both of us trying to get a few more people in the town, especially, because I think we have a pretty good show coming up here. And mm-hmm. I know these restaurants all have very good food.
No, that's a good way of showing how the arts do help local businesses, in addition to just selling tickets to shows, but people come to town and spend their money elsewhere as well. The value of a good arts organization can't really be measured too conservatively. You are a founder, a past president, and current co-president of the theater company. Let me tell you my suspicion of how that came about. I was once a area governor of an organization, and part of the job was to go around visit other groups in that organization and play Big Shot twice a year. And then I was told the most important part of the job was to find my successor. It took me 2 years to find my successor. Now, I suspect that you served a term as president and figured you were going to pass it off to somebody else, and somebody else wouldn't take it unless you stayed on as co-president.
Well, not quite, but I was president for, I'm not sure, I think 8 or 10 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I passed it on to someone else. I think they had it for probably 8, and she decided to give it up, and we elected a new one just recently. Probably, I think it's 2 years ago. And the president we elected turned to me, and she says, well, I would like some help with this. Jim, would you be co-presidents with me? Well, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it works. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Amory Community Theater. When was it organized, and how do you operate? How many shows do you do a year?
We started up roughly 20 years ago. I think this will be our 20th year now. 94, I'm pretty sure we got started. Four of us got together and decided, well, we were all working in theater a little bit here and there. We decided to get together and start one of our own so we could do some other productions, bigger stuff, get into musicals and whatnot. So that's how we got going. Just went to the Amory schools and talked to community education, and they said they would fund us for our first production, and they did. At that time, we did Harvey. We made some money. So we put all the money into an account and been working on that ever since. Mm-hmm. We've gone through some major, some major stuff in the past, some really, really big musicals, and done pretty good. So it's just kind of flowed. So we keep going and pick things up.
He is Jim Thompson, who is director of the Amory Community Theater production of Dixie Swim Club. Well, your background seems to indicate that a person doesn't really need a Master of Fine Arts degree in theater to become afflicted by the theater addiction. So what got you started?
Driving school bus for New Richmond Schools. We took a field trip to the Children's Theater in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. While we were unloading the kids, they came out and said, well, you guys can come in for nothing if you want. And I said, okay, fine. The other bus driver and I went and sat down and watched the performance. I was just totally amazed at how good it was. I had never seen anything like that, and I was just utterly enveloped in what was going on. Well, probably a year or so later, I got tickets to another theater in town and watched the show, and the guy that was in the production came up and he asked me if I would like to be in theater. And I said, well, I don't really know. I've never done this. And he kept talking to me. I said, okay, fine. I'll give it a shot. He said, I got one coming up. He said, I asked him, what is it? He said, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, boy.
Well, I wind up my first production ever. I am playing Thug, the Joiner.
Oh.
Midsummer Night's Dream.
Ah, yes.
Which we got on to, got going. I kind of had a lot of fun with it. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of stuck with that for 3 or 4 years doing different things. Well, it was with Lemoyne McLaughlin in Northern Lake Center.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
A bunch of us got together and started the Amory Community Theater from there.
So. Now, you've been directing, you started directing after a couple of years?
It was probably 2 years after, 95, I started directing. And we lost our director. We needed someone to take over, and there was nobody really popping up to do it. So I said, well, fine, I'll raise my hand. I was curious anyway. But kind of had it ever since. Just kind of strange that I wound up in this position, but I guess, it's working for me.
Apparently it must work for everybody else, or they wouldn't keep you around.
We've had other people come in and direct also, but they come in, they do, a couple, 2, 3 of them, and then decide it's enough, and it's back to me again.
Yeah, sometimes community theaters are able to develop, their own core of directors from mm-hmm. people who live in the area and that perhaps can do one show a year or something like that. Then it makes it a little bit easier on everybody than to have somebody come in and do everything for a whole season. You do seem to do an awful lot of stuff, according to your biographical information. You are now in the process of writing a cookbook.
Yeah, it's been... an ongoing process, just kind of collecting recipes. I've been cooking since I was 6 years old, basically.
Mm.
And I've always felt that any person, man, woman, whoever, should be able to at least feed themselves. They should have enough knowledge about the stove and how to cook ingredients and everything so that they can feed themselves. They may not necessarily feed anybody else, but at least themselves. And one thing I've tried to do as best as possible is when I'm working with a recipe, I may change it slightly one way or another to add this or take that out. And most of the stuff I've done has been experimentation with basic recipes. A really quick example is a mac and cheese. And what I like to do with it is throw in some cheddar, Swiss, and my favorite is putting some hot pepper cheese in there.
Oh, boy.
Melting that cheese in with the mac and cheese. And it gives a really different consistency and a really different flavor. So this is kind of where the cookbook is going. Cook up something that's a little bit different.
Years ago, I was a single man, and I bought a house. Some friends of mine had a housewarming. Somebody gave me, I'm sure as a gag gift, a Betty Crocker cookbook, Cooking for One. It was the most practical thing I ever got in my life. Yep. It was just so helpful. Getting back to the Dixie Swim Club, how does one buy tickets other than going to one of the restaurants you mentioned?
You can buy tickets at Jet Johnson's Drug and Amory also. All the restaurants have them too, or a cast member. If you know a cast member, you should be able to get them from them too.
Okay. Well, the play is Dixie Swim Club, and it will be performed on March 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 27th, 28th, and 29th at the Amory High School Auditorium. We've been talking to the director, Jim Thompson. Thanks so much for being with us.
I thank you for having me, Jim. I really appreciate this.
And we appreciate Jim Oliver. This is Spectrum West. Here's a Spectrum memo of what's happening at the Phipps in Hudson. Tuesday the 25th, it's the stand-up comedy showcase, 7:30 p.m. Next Friday the 28th at 7:30, and Saturday at 2 p.m., the Phipps dance companies perform modern, contemporary, jazz, lyrical, hip-hop, and tap. Sunday the 30th, it's the Sheldon Theater Brass Band at 7 p.m. Classes beginning include ceramic studio, concrete sculpture and mosaic, theater for young people, and yoga for youngsters. Always something going on at the Phipps. The website is thephipps.org. The phone number is 386-2305, 386-2305. Patrick O'Brien is educated and trained as an actor. He's been around a very big block many times. He's been in showbiz for a number of years, from Eau Claire to the furthest stretches of America's West and East. Big stages, small stages, motion picture cameras, and those that shoot for TV. And now living in the Twin Cities, he's always looking forward to doing more in varied roles. When possible, he frequents the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. This weekend, he's gracing the surroundings known as the Elbow Room, their small black box theater, to offer a one-man presentation called The Fever. You've done some challenging roles over the years. From what you've told me previously, this ranks right up there with the most challenging, yeah?
Well, but actually I'd say that most of the roles I've done are not that challenging. Back in Hollywood, I would get small roles, a line here, a line there. But that's one of the reasons why I kind of moved back to the Twin Cities, was to try to dig up some more challenging roles and stuff. Out of the small parts, I was, a lot of small parts, but small.
Well, your stage roles, though, have been
cool. Yeah. Certainly more substantial than TV or film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a, you're up on stage alone. This is kind of a struggle piece. I mean, there must be a lot that goes into this.
Yeah, and I'd never really, in my career, ever wanted actually to do one-man shows. It kind of scared me. Even monologues, doing a monologue in a play is pretty daunting for me. But I did this other one-man show, Underneath the Lintel.
Yep.
Which, I auditioned for it when I was in L.A. and just loved the part and the character and didn't get cast, but always wanted to do it. So when I came back, it was about 5 years ago that I first did that one. And that went quite well. And in fact, I'm still doing it, traveling around the country doing it. And then now I want another piece that I can take back to some of the theaters that I did the first one-man show at. This is what I picked. And it's you're right. It's a challenge.
Well, and so there must be specific rewards for taking on a challenge of, being a one-man show. At first, you didn't want to do that kind of thing, and then you found that it was something that was you.
I enjoyed a lot. Like I said, I've been doing the first one-man show for about 5 years, and on and off, and so I let it go for a few months, but then each time when I get another booking and I kind of start revisiting it in my mind, going over the lines, it's like visiting an old friend. So it's I enjoy it a lot. And I don't know, I always have this thing when I'm, well, not always, but usually when I'm acting with other people on stage, I have this weird voice in my head, this governor kind of saying, kind of directing all the time in my head what these other people are doing. Oh, you shouldn't have said it that way. Oh, you blew that laugh line, and things like I'm kind of commenting in my head about what the other actors are doing. So in this case, I'm commenting in my own head about how I'm goofing up.
So do you feel like you're on stage alone, or do you go into a mindset where you may feel like there's at least a couple of you having a conversation?
No, you're up there.
It's just you, huh?
Up there by yourself. But yeah, you do. Yeah, you're kind of right. I mean, you go into this other state.
So it's kind of Patrick O'Brien and then the character.
Oh yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Separate challenges and rewards for comedy versus drama? You've done both?
Yeah, and in fact, both of these pieces have a lot of comedy, but a lot of drama, a lot of pathos in them as well. It's always nice to get laughs, but it's always nice when it's dead quiet, too, you know, in the serious spots. So,
I mean, the laughter is the instant gratification. You kind of know how it's going over.
Yeah.
Dead silence is the same, huh?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Huh. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And you can tell. When I say dead silence, I really mean it. A lot of times in comedies, you hear that shuffling and the coughing and just little noises. But when it's a serious drama and you're in those heavy parts of the script,
sure.
When it's completely silent, you can feel it. It's tangible.
I would guess maybe a sniffle would really take it over the top.
Well, that's a good point. That has happened. Yeah.
Tell me what goes into the process of selecting the things you do. Do you have kind of a formula designed to keep you on your toes, like a certain number of projects each year?
Not a formula, but... Yes, I am kind of, when I moved back to the Twin Cities, I was expecting more theaters to be hiring me directly, and that hasn't been happening on a regular basis. So I've been producing my own plays and, these two one-man shows. And I got a couple other ones, Heroes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We've been touring for a number of years. And this other one, Rounding Third, which I'm probably going to hang up. I'm pretty old for that role. I'm supposed to be a guy who's coaching his kids' Little League team. Although I do have a kid who's going to be in Little League this year, my son, I'm usually mistaken for his grandfather, so let's hang that one up.
You have a lot on your plate. Patrick O'Brien on the phone with us. The play is called, it's a one-manner, The Fever, and it's at the Festival Theater in their Elbow Room. That's a cool place. It's Friday through Sunday. It's written by Wallace Shawn. Tell us a bit about him. I mean, he's also an actor. He's one of those guys... I went online and looked him up. His name you might not recognize, but his face, that's another story.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah, you probably didn't recognize his name, but yeah, his face and his voice. He does a lot of cartoony voices.
Ah, okay.
He's on, I think, Family Guy, and he was in Toy Story. I think he was a dinosaur, I think. So he's done a lot of work, but he's an interesting man in that, especially when you... take into context the play itself, The Fever. It's, I think, somewhat autobiographical in that Wallace Shawn was the son of William Shawn, who was the editor of The New Yorker for many years.
Mm.
So Wallace grew up amidst the rarefied air of the New York literati. Is that a word? Literati? I think it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And The Fever is about this man who... is also affluent, but he travels to these poor revolutionary countries, probably Nicaragua or something, back in the 80s in Central America, and he faces, extreme poverty, and he feels this guilt, and I'm not sure if Wallace ever did travel there, but he very well might have. I've looked up a couple of interviews, and he never mentions that he traveled there, but the play has this ring of authenticity that, maybe Wallace did go there to see what was going on. Now, mm-hmm. Wallace is a very liberal, probably even considers himself a socialist, I don't know. In fact, I had a friend who went to Nicaragua when all this was happening in the 80s and the Contras and how we were supporting, Reagan and North were supporting the Contras versus the Marxists who had taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend came back very bitter with what we were doing, very bitter toward the U.S. And I think Shawn also was bitter for what we did. Anyway, the character goes there, and he's finds himself in a strange hotel room, and he has a fever. That's the name of the play. And he goes into this Kafkaesque fever dream where he's, vomiting, and yet having this, laid out, stretched out on the bathroom floor, and he can't get up to go to back to bed. He is so ill.
Mm.
But in this fever dream, then he has these kind of a confrontation with his own conscience, almost being attacked physically and, intellectually by the poor people that he imagines, kind of hallucinates, are there as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Powerful piece, yeah.
No kidding. So you have to vomit and you have to sweat and you...
I won't be vomiting, no.
Oh, you won't be vomiting, no. I see, okay.
Yeah, he narrates, it's kind of a flashback. He's recalling what happened.
The... well, good. I wasn't... that sort of scratched it off for me when you said vomiting, so I didn't... I wasn't coming after that.
I'm sorry. I'm glad you clarified that for your listeners. Yeah.
I'm impressed with actors who can cry on cue, but to vomit on cue, that... That would take it for me. You have an affinity for the Festival Theater. This time it's kind of in the Elbow Room. Not kind of, it is in the Elbow Room.
Yeah.
That's very up close and personal. Actors, some anyway, seem to like that proximity to the spectators.
It depends on the play.
Does that make them less watchers and maybe more involved with what you're doing when you're in places like the Elbow Room?
Well, I think it depends on the play. And a one-person show, usually needs that intimacy, so it's more effective there.
Well, they really can't do too many other kinds of productions in a black box theater, can they, or do they?
No. Well, we did Heroes there with three people, and I'm not sure. They haven't done a lot of plays there. They have music in there regularly, kind of a cabaret type thing.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, now that you mention it, Wallace Shawn, when he first, he performed the piece. He did it starting off in people's living rooms. Rich New York friends, he'd do it in their living rooms, and then it was successful, and then he did it off-Broadway, and it won an Obie in 1991, I believe, for best play. But yeah, the play lends itself to a venue like the Elbow Room.
That's probably why they took the vomiting scene out, because it was in living rooms.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw on the CBS Sunday Morning last week a segment about Elaine Stritch. She is so cool. She's on the western slopes of her career, and she was so passionate talking about how she lives to entertain and that applause is almost like food and water for her. Without it, she said, who knows, what I would do. Is that what stage is like for you?
That's why stage work is preferred by a lot of actors over TV and film. You have that audience. Although TV, you have a lot of sitcoms are filmed in front of a live audience, so you do kind of get that same feeling of doing a little mini play when you're doing a sitcom. Uh-huh. Yeah, doing film, film lasts forever, sometimes. So that's, one, well, not forever, nothing lasts forever, but so that's one up that... that film has over stage, but she's right. Having that intimacy and that back and forth with the audience is very, very rewarding.
This is a question that's off the cuff. You ever find yourself accepting and committing to a project and then sitting back and going, what the hell am I doing?
Yes. Yeah.
And but then most of the time that trepidation goes away when you literally perform it.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. If you were correct in your early assessment, your trepidation, it doesn't go well, then sometimes those first instincts are correct. In fact, tomorrow I give a speech at the university, and I'm not a speech maker and giver. I like to have everything memorized, and, I'm quite nervous about that.
Sweaty palms.
Yep. The theme is joy.
Ah.
How we bring joy to our work.
That's all right, though. You just go into an acting mode.
I have a script there, I can refer to.
Oh, sure.
I wish it was. I had time to memorize it. I am actually going to act out a little bit, a couple of joyous monologues. Or actually, They're not joyous. They're people who are kind of mired in misery who want some joy in their lives.
Well, actors always find joy at the end of a run, don't they? At the end of a show? Actually, I'm glad I did that.
Well,
that was fun.
On the contrary. I mean, again, you go back to your previous point about going into a project with trepidation. If it doesn't go all that well, then you're happy it's over. But if it's a good, successful run, then
sure.
No, on the contrary, you're sad to see it go. And for, you know, that next week, you know, instead of going into the theater every night and you're sitting at home, there's that big empty spot in your life.
I can't help but to think, though, that if you approach something with trepidation, you can be partly to blame for the fact that it didn't go well. That's a whole science that would take us an hour to talk about, I'll bet.
Probably right. If optimism or pessimism is better, or if you just have to weigh both sides.
Well, Mr. O'Brien, I'm sorry I'm a day late, but I wanted to wish you a belated happy St. Pat's Day.
Yeah, did you hear about the guy who was so Irish, his blood type was O apostrophe?
You got me going. I'm a good audience. Thanks for being with us on Spectrum West. I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome.
Keep in touch, too, by the way, will you?
Yeah.
All right, see you. Patrick O'Brien, starring in The Fever. You can check it out at the Festival Theater, but for one weekend only, this weekend. It's in the Black Box Theater up close and personal. Showtime, 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday. The box office number is 483-3387. Box office at festivaltheater.org. Theater has R-E at the end. That's how they spell it. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio and Spectrum West comes from the Water Street Deli in Eau Claire, offering fresh hummus, baba ganoush, and pita chips. We have it here periodically. Available at the deli, the downtown farmers market, and Just Local Food on Facebook and at waterstreetdeliandgrocery.com. Well, Jerry Way is past retirement age, but retiring's the last thing on his mind, at least from involvement in a musical world. The first thing is to maintain energy for all things creative by writing at least a couple shows a year. His latest is called Gold Town Showdown. As usual, it opens soon at his favorite venue, the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. He stopped by with his guitar the other day. My first question was about the process, how long it took to write this latest script.
Well, spring and a little bit of summer.
Last year.
Yeah.
I made up a slogan, by the way.
And the slogan is?
Yeah, that has to do with you and your relationship with the Heide Center. You want to hear it?
Yeah, sure.
Where there's a hill, there's a way.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
I like it.
You have a lot of things rolling around in your head. How did this theme come to you? Or is this one thing you've always wanted to work on? Or have you done one of these before?
A few years ago, Carol and I took a vacation to Colorado. And we went to Fandango and, Durango and Silverton. Durango becomes Fandango in the play, and Silverton becomes Gold Town. And the little railroad is in there, a little narrow gauge railroad that goes up the mountain in between. And we set it in 1889, which is the heyday of mining and prospecting.
So when you were there, you had a thought, someday I'm going to write a show about this kind of thing? Or did you just remember the trip when you were brushing your teeth one day?
Yeah, I don't think at the time I was thinking it at all. But going over the photos, Carol took a lot of great photos, and they became the inspiration of her set for the play, too. Mm-hmm. But the whole story, the setting spoke to me first, and then the characters started coming through.
All right, so now the setting is Colorado. How tough is that to reproduce at the Heide Center as far as staging goes? Has
that
been a challenge?
Well, artistically, there's mountains in there. We have a river. We have a saloon. We have an emporium. We have the train. So quite a bit of it's right there.
So this was around the time when gold was being discovered there. The blueprint of this show could be, and you finished the sentence for me, greed meets what?
Greed meets innocence, I guess.
Innocence.
Clem, the prospector, he staked a claim, but he just finds nothing but a nugget here and there. But he invited everybody to come up and join him, build a town on his claim.
Mm-hmm.
And then this ruthless railroad baron named Bart finds out that the town is built right on a big motherload of gold, unknown to anyone else. So he arranges a showdown to steal the claim.
So he's not interested in the railroad.
Well, he's already made a fortune in railroads. Owns every business in Fandango. He's very, very rich, but he's always ready to win something else.
So what you're saying is it's never enough for Bart.
Oh, no. Greed, like okay. I said, greed.
And as you said, like many Westerns, there's a showdown, but yes, this turns out to be, it's not the same kind of showdown we're used to seeing, is it?
Well, when Bart challenges Clem to a showdown, he leaves that makes the choice of weapon be Clem's. And Clem considers all sorts of weapons, which he's no good at. He's no good at any using any weapons or fighting at all. Mm-hmm. So he chooses a showdown.
Ah.
And so there is a big show competition between Fandango and Gold Town. And there's no love lost between the two of them anyway, so they're all game for getting involved.
Is it held at a neutral location?
It's held at the location was picked too. So Bart picks the time, the sundown Saturday, and then Clem gets to pick the place, you know, so it goes back and forth. But it's the Gold Town Saloon is where it is held. But they have a neutral judge, a very honest Wild West showman named Buffalo George. And any similarity to Buffalo Bill is quite intentional, I guess. Yeah.
Jerry Way is with us in the studio. He has his guitar. We'll be getting to a tune shortly. It's called Gold Town Showdown. It's at the Heidi Center, and it opens next Thursday, the 27th. So let me guess, Bart wears black a lot?
You're right. Okay. Yeah.
Does he have a mustache?
Yes, he does.
Does he twirl it like sneaky, Snidely
Whiplash?
Yeah,
sneaky look about him.
Sneaky, yeah. I always wanted to be cast as one of those guys.
Yeah, I think he's having a lot of fun with the part.
Speaking of cast, who do you have in the lead roles?
Clem is played by Tim Danielson,
okay,
the prospector, and he's widowed, and his grown daughter is played by Laura Ballrude,
mm-hmm.
And then Bart is played by Tom Fuchs. And his emporium manager is kind of involved with this cowboy, Lucky, who's played by Keith Pitch, and Scarlett, this emporium manager that ends up being involved with three different men in the play, is played by Barb Sinakis.
So you develop relationships within the show. You've got a father-daughter relationship,
right? And all this takes place within 1 week, but a lot happens in that week.
They sing to each other, and you have happy songs, and you have sentimental songs.
Yeah. Okay. There's some of each. Yeah.
And you have a good guy versus a villain. That's a good relationship to develop in any show. Yeah. And you use music instead of violence,
right? And lots of comedy too. All sorts of it.
Before I ask a couple more questions, why don't you give us some tunes? Because I know there's like 12 in the show, right?
Yeah, 12 new songs.
Songs by the dozen.
The cowboy Lucky is talking to Bart about this plan for the showdown and talking about the animosity between the two towns. But Lucky's never heard this word before, so he says, animosity. Now there's a most unusual the oddest word I've ever heard. It sounds like nothing I have seen. So tell me, please, what does it mean? Animosity, animosity. You know it when you feel it. Deep hostility mixed with jealousy leads to animosity. Those ornery folks up in Gold Town make fun of us and put us down. How dare they mock our style of dress when their attire is one big mess. Animosity. Animosity, you know it when you feel it. Deep hostility mixed with jealousy leads to animosity. Leads to animosity.
All right. And that's who's singing it?
That's Lucky and Lucky. All of the Fandanguins.
What are some of the names of some of the other tunes in the show?
Well, we have one called Let's Put on a Show.
Mm-hmm.
We have one that's called Paradise Mountain, because that's sort of the setting of the whole thing, and it opens and closes the show. There's one that is dedicated to the cowboy, and it's just named Lucky. It's mm-hmm. sort of a love mm-hmm. song, like mm-hmm. you say, a sentimental song. We have...
So does he get Lucky?
Oh, no. Well, he does. Finally, at the very, very
does
end.
Does he? Okay.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. We'll keep that
I don't want to keep
sort of
alone.
Under wraps a little bit. But, yeah. And then
I was worried about him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He seemed alone.
I hope the audience will be, too.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You have, obviously, lots of people to thank for putting on a program like this. We talked about the artistic side of it and the choreography and things. You gave us some leading players. Any other names of people who are working behind the scenes for you on this show?
Well, yes. Well, my wife, Carol, designed and the set, and she's had Lori Petterlich working with her painting and Eric Nielsen building sets. Barb Bucher doing wonderful job with costumes, mm-hmm. And then our lighting crew will be led by Jerry Brust. Judy Brist is our piano accompanist, and then we'll have a trio. I'll be playing string bass, and then Ron Gard on drums as our combo for it.
It's obviously, as you said, you started this show writing it last spring and summer. Do you ever get to a point sometimes where you have a brainstorm and you start writing something and you say, "Man, that's not going to work. That's not going to be a show." Anything ever end up in the wastebasket?
That happens. I think I had something else started, in fact, this year.
Ah.
And then the Colorado kind of jumped up and took over.
Okay.
And I've forgotten what it was, but I know for sure there was something else I was working on. But
couldn't have been good if it's forgettable.
Right, right. And that's the whole thing.
All right, so now you're putting on this show, you have a number of dinner shows. You have the dinner show capability with this.
Right, and it'll be a stage side right in the theater. The first one of ours that they've done that with, and they're doing a barbecue for beef and chicken, and then on Friday there'll be a fish, baked fish option. So option of those three things. And Thursday, Friday, Saturday will be the dinner theater. Sunday is the theater performance.
Mm-hmm. So you have a show in the end of March. What do you do after that? How much time do you take off before you say, all right, got to do another one?
It's kind of settled into I'll start writing the spring. I'll start writing one for next March. And I've already written one in the fall that I write for the Swampers. And we do our Swampers show as part of Pure Water Days. So I write those in the fall. And it's kind of worked into a little routine of two shows a year that way.
Mm-hmm. Where there's a hill, there's a way.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Jerry Way, break a leg.
Thank you very much.
Go to the Heidi Center website for tickets, cvca.net. In coming weeks, the Jazz Festival North High School puts on a musical, a sculpture tour, Sean Carey, the band Red Molly, and more. Next week, the Confluence. Should we or shouldn't we? We'll dedicate the entire show, half to those who don't like the idea, half to those who think it's a great idea. That's next week, Thursday, 10 a.m. right here, and Friday at 7 p.m. on the news and classical music stations in West Wisconsin. Be here for a very important program. Thanks for being here today. I'm Al Ross. I appreciate you. See you next week.